This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're doing No Country for Old Men, and I'll kick us off. No Country for Old Men came out in 2007. It was directed by the Coen brothers and based on the novel of the same name by Cormac McCarthy. A man comes upon a drug deal gone wrong. He finds a couple million dollars in cash in a briefcase. This man is a welder and a veteran of the Vietnam War. He lives in a tiny, wretched little house together with his wife. He takes the briefcase. He ignores the pleas for water of one man who is dying but not yet dead. That night, he feels guilty about the dying man and returns with a gallon of water. Of course, by this point, the man is long dead and members of the gang are searching for the money. They see him and they shoot him in the back. He heads for the river. They send their dog after him. He kills the dog and gets away. Now he knows they're after him, so he sends his wife to her mother's place and takes the money with him to a hotel. What he doesn't know is that the briefcase has a tracker in it. As long as he's with the money, they can find him. They hire a psychopath to pursue him. The psychopath recently escaped from jail by murdering the officer on duty. He kills people for reasons that seem arbitrary. Much of the film is devoted to the question of what to make of this fellow. Does he have principles? What are they? Even though the guy with the money has military experience, his sanity is clearly a handicap. The psychopath does things that don't make any sense. He returns to crime scenes, and he kills people who are only tangentially involved in the plot, often deciding their fates by flipping a coin. The psychopath can't be reasoned with. You can't make a deal with him. And what's more, it's clear that the psychopath finds these efforts to reason with him confusing. For the psychopath, it's very obvious that he must do these things, and he cannot understand why anyone bothers trying to persuade him otherwise. There's a sheriff who tries to put a stop to all this, but he's always one step behind. The sheriff's inability to catch up to the psychopath has a demoralizing effect, ultimately ending in the sheriff's retirement. The sheriff is particularly bad at making sense of the psychopath. Often he tries to explain the psychopath's behavior in conservative cliches. There's been social decline, the sheriff says. Things used to be better in the old days. But at multiple points in the film, other characters push back against this easy narrative. Even insofar as there has been social decline, the psychopath cannot be explained in terms of it. His behavior is too abnormal to be explained by general social trends. At the end of the film, one character pushes back against the decline narrative directly, telling a story about his uncle, who was killed on his porch in 1908. This has always been a violent place, and people have always died unjustly. America has always been an unjust place, and if the sheriff thinks he can, by his individual actions, stop this or change this, he suffers from vanity. Ultimately, the psychopath follows the man with the briefcase to Mexico and back, eventually killing him at a motel. In a failed attempt at negotiations, the psychopath threatened to kill the man's wife if the man did not hand over the briefcase. Since the man never handed over the briefcase, the psychopath feels compelled to keep his promise to kill the wife. He finds her, and when she tries to say he doesn't have to do this, he mocks her for failing to understand the rules by which he lives. He offers to flip a coin to decide the matter, but she refuses to call it, insisting that he is making the decision, not the coin. The psychopath points out that he and the coin have come here by the same process, that there is no meaningful difference between his decision and the coin's. Both the coin and the psychopath have come here by the same rule, in the sense that they have both arrived through the processes that govern the universe in which we live. Whatever we don't like about the psychopath, we must admit that the psychopath is part of our universe, that he got here the same way we got here, that we are all part of the same system, the same unfolding whole. Those who deny this, who argue that individuals are free to make decisions that defy these processes, have a position that strikes the psychopath as ridiculous. And I do think he has a point here. The sheriff's delusion that he can, by his individual actions, overturn the injustice that marks the whole universe is, in an important sense, just as crazy as the psychopath's own behavior. It may be morally more defensible or more attractive from certain points of view, but it is arguably even more out of touch with reality. The psychopath has the bad fortune of being a psychopath. He cannot be something else. And really, is it his fault he is what he is? There's a suggestion here that some people are just born that way. But ultimately, no person is bigger than the whole, and that includes the psychopath. After he kills the wife, on the drive back, he gets T-boned. The psychopath was not driving erratically. He wasn't violating any traffic laws. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Over and over, the psychopath has suggested that if other people are living in a way that puts them in his way, the way they have chosen to live has more to do with their fate than he does. Now the psychopath himself finds that he has lived in a way that put him in front of a truck. Wounded, but not dead, he is forced to flee the scene, lest he be arrested. He pays a kid for a shirt, which he uses to make a tourniquet. This mirrors an earlier scene on the Mexican border, where the man with the briefcase made a similar deal with a local drunk. Again, the implication is that as different as the psychopath appears, there is less difference between him and us than we would like to think. Ultimately, all three of these men, the man with the briefcase, the sheriff, and the psychopath, live violent lives that put them and those around them in danger. Each of them has his rationale, his justification, his set of rules, but all three find themselves in similar situations, behaving similarly. Each thinks that his rule makes him wiser or smarter than the others, but this is vanity, and ultimately each pays the price for his hubris. None of them are bigger than the unfolding totality of which all three are a part, and to try to control events as if one stood outside them never leads where we would like it to lead. In this way, Cormac McCarthy makes our fallibility into a consolation. No matter how dastardly any one of us may seem, none of us are able to control events absolutely. Both the just man and the unjust man can be undone by pride. And so while justice does not triumph, neither does injustice. If we toss a coin with justice on one side and injustice on the other, we will not always get the same result. Of course, a universe where you get a bad result half the time is no wonderful place, but there is an awful lot of difference between getting the bad ending half the time and getting it in every case. Cormac McCarthy does not promise us that justice will triumph, but he does remind us that injustice won't either. Is that enough of a reason to go on struggling for justice? At the end of the film, the sheriff's retirement doesn't seem to be going well. He has two dreams. First, he dreams he lost something his dead father gave him. Second, he dreams his dead father is preparing a campfire ahead for him. In quitting the struggle because he could not decisively win it, the sheriff has rejected life itself. His retirement is a tantrum. It throws away the life his father gave him, and it commits him to joining his father in death. That's how I read the film, anyway. Let's see what Nina thinks.
Well, I suppose, first of all, just on the scene with the wife and the psychopath, I did not read this scene as him necessarily having killed the wife. I understand that this is what he promises. I understand that this is what he has come there to do, ostensibly. But I think it's deliberately left ambiguous, at least in the film, right? I'm not sure about the book, the novel. But because, obviously, we don't see him kill her, and she refuses the coin toss, the coin decision. And I think her point about he has a choice, right? He says, everybody always says the same thing. You don't have to do this, right? And obviously, in some cases, he flips the coin and he does, and in other cases, he doesn't because the coin says no. But I'm not sure he's encountered anybody who's refused the coin toss, at least insofar as we understand it. So I think there is also a space left open for the possibility that the refusal of the coin by the wife doesn't necessarily mean that she is killed. Just maybe this is an overly optimistic reading, and we come back to this. The second point on the car crash. Yes, I agree that this is a point about circumstance. I don't think he runs the light. The other guy runs the light. Right? So that he is the victim of an accident, right? He's the victim of circumstance. And I think that the category that we're talking about here is moral luck, which is partly to do with the way in which we are, we find ourselves in particular circumstances with particular character. And like you say, one possibility, of course, or one way of seeing things is that the chauffeur or the psychopath cannot help but be the psychopath. So to what extent can we attribute things like the call of conscience and responsibility to him. But I do think the coin toss and the possibility of the coin toss being refused by the wife, and the repeated phrase, "You don't have to do this," is not just to be understood as a plea for not being killed by him, but rather an acknowledgement of the possibility of conscience, even in the most removed person. I thought this was a very interesting film. I hadn't actually finished watching it before because I tried watching it once and I found it so violent and brutal that I had to stop. But I must admit, it took me three times to, I had to watch it in three parts this time, but I did manage to watch it. I find the Coen Brothers films, even the ones that are not particularly violent, somewhat inhuman or inhumane. There's a kind of coldness at the heart of many of their films, which I have always struggled with. However, I do think because this film is partly about the incomprehensibility of evil, and as you know, I've been teaching this course on evil for the past few weeks, and in that sense, it was very interesting to reflect on this character and of the nature of evil precisely in its incomprehensibility, because this is one of the things that characterizes the difficulty of pinning down the concept itself, right? Precisely, it's often defined negatively. Augustine's, you know, it's the privation or the absence of good. It's a lack of something, or it is chaos, it's disorder, it's darkness in some of the earlier mythological and religious theological descriptions. But I think one understanding that's very dominant of the concept of evil, particularly in modernity, is its incomprehensibility. It's simply something that doesn't make sense in the way that we would normally be able to attribute other motives. So, of course, Shigure, the psychopath, is motivated by greed, we could say, to some degree. I mean, after all, he's after the money, right? This is a motive, we could say. Maybe the way he's going about getting it is highly unorthodox, indeed terrifying. But we could say we understand why he's doing what he's doing. The same for all of the characters in the film to some degree. They're motivated by the promise of early retirement, by the desire to protect family, by, you know, the desire to serve or the desire for justice. I think you're right that there is a kind of open-endedness or another mirroring of the incomprehensibility of evil in the desire for justice and the misrecognition of justice in the detective. So if that's the case, then we have a kind of pair or a sort of dualism, which is between evil and justice. So not injustice and justice, but rather evil and justice, which is an interesting one, which seems appropriate to the Cormac McCarthy that I've read, which is not all of it. And again, when I've tried to read Blood Meridian, I found it very difficult because of the cold violence, and it's a very masculine type of writing, I think. There's not, you know, that is what it is. It's very brutal. It's kind of relentless. I think the use of mirrors in the film is very, very good. Like, one of the excellent things about the way this film is done is the repeated use of mirrors and shadows. So, for example, when the detective drinks the milk that Shigure has recently left behind, we see their shadow in almost exactly the same position. They do the same action. They do it in the same place. There is a kind of mirroring and mimicking of the dark side, the shadow side, and the implication that in order to understand Shigure, one must also understand one's own dark side, which is one of the problems of a kind of dualism that sees evil in the psychopath but not in oneself, or seeks to place it there. You know, when we are, if not equally, but certainly we also participate in incomprehensibility, in evil acts and evil intentions, if not to that same degree. The question then of how we understand the psychopath, whether we are able to do it, is also a question about whether we can understand ourselves and our own participation, as you say, in the cosmos, our own place, our own moral luck that sees us positioned partly by happenstance, partly by necessity, in the place that we are, in the circumstances that we find ourselves, and our capacity to decide what to do. And I've been thinking this week, particularly about the phrase, the straight and narrow, which is an interesting phrase. It's a phrase that is a kind of regulatory ideal, I suppose, about how to lead a moral life, you know, that one must be on the straight and narrow. So there's a sort of straight path, but it's also a very, very narrow path, right? Because for fear of falling off the sides. It's obviously not enough that the path be straight, because we could say that Chagur's path is straight. He's the most determined character in the whole film. It's not enough that it's narrow either, because one could be extremely focused on a very particular idea obsessively. So I think this phrase means something that I am yet to comprehend perhaps fully. But just to wrap up, I suppose, my initial thoughts, I read this film as a kind of Western. I think it's also about the formation of America. And we've spoken a few times about the fact that every civilization is founded on a violent act or a series of violent acts that it then seeks to forget through the instantiation of law, because this is simply how things are founded. And I think the Western as a genre, whether we understand this as a kind of Western, is partly about the forgetting of the moral evil that founds every civilization and whose trace remains, whether the trace remains in figures like Chagur, whether we can understand the psychopath as a symptom or as a consequence of a founding act of violence, that these people are thrown up by precisely that history that's understood through blood and in blood, the blood of the country and the blood of the people that are in it. So whilst we could accept that, for example, America has always been an unjust place, we might also seek to pretend that it has also not been evil foundationally. We might think that there was always good and there was always justice at its foundation too, which makes it much harder, I think, to cope with, I suppose, to understand that one is part of a project which is both good and evil, both just and unjust, and that these things carry on unfolding in us as individuals, in us as members of a community. And I think with the sort of weaponization of history that we often see when it comes to things like slavery and colonialism, there is a kind of, a too easy, too lazy, too quick, but also kind of hysterical attempt to position people either on the side of good or on the side of bad, and to condemn the past unequivocally in favor of a sort of fantasy of the present as a kind of cleansed good. But it never really can be cleansed enough. So there's always this residuum of guilt, which is then sort of borne by people, particularly if they feel that they have benefited, often in some very, very murky way, from the excesses of the past. And it's interesting to think about those projects. There's a big one in the UK that's been going on for a few years, which is to try to pin down which families owned slaves, for example, right? So this is not just a general hand-wavy, we're all responsible for slaves if we're bought, if you're British, do you know what I mean? It's not that kind of generalizing invocation of history, but rather to look at specific families and to say, well, your family owned slaves at this point. And I wonder what you think about these kind of restorative archival projects, whether they are useful, whether they are better or worse than the kind of black and white history bad, present, hopefully good, getting better, progressive narrative. that still nevertheless maintains this kind of deep guilt, deep well of guilt that can be drawn upon. But yeah, those are my opening thoughts.
Interesting. So the reason that I just treat it as a fact that he kills her, even though he doesn't kill her on screen, there are two core reasons. One is that when he steps out of the house, he checks his boots, which is something he does at other points in the film when he kills somebody to try to stop the boots from becoming bloodied. His biggest concern after he kills someone is whether he gets blood on him. So the fact that he feels the need to look at the boots, he was in a house. It wasn't a filthy place. There's no reason to check your boots for anything unsightly unless you've killed somebody in the house. The other reason I don't take the cutting away to mean that there's ambiguity is that as the film goes on, more and more violent acts occur off screen. In the opening parts of the film, it's very violent. You see a lot of the violence. You know, he strangles the cop and you see him do that. But as the film goes on, you see the evidence of what he's done and you see less and less the acts themselves. And this is something that I think distinguishes No Country for Old Men a little bit from the rest of the Coen's oeuvre. There is, and I think it comes from the fact that it's an adaptation of Cormac McCarthy, more of a concern with morality and good and evil in this film than in a lot of other Coen brothers films. And for that reason, this stepping away from the violence, I think in some ways is meant to underline the degree to which this is really quite serious stuff and shouldn't be treated as irreverently as we're accustomed to treating it. And the film kind of moves us from a perspective where we're accustomed to this violence. It's normal. It's routine. We don't think too much about it. To one where we're confronted with the very grave seriousness of it.
Mm. Okay, I mean, I like this as an explanation, particularly in the context of their films in general, which, as I said, I sometimes feel very uneasy about. I think in the same way that I often feel uneasy about Tarantino films and the use of violence in those films as kind of ironic or formal gesture, do you know what I mean? And so I take your point about the decreasing visual presence of violence to indicate a more serious approach in the context also, not just of the adaptation, but of their entire genre and perhaps of cinema itself. I suppose my heart just wants that she isn't killed. I just really don't want her to die. And then perhaps perhaps that's why I want there to be hope. But I mean, this is, you know, I want it to have been the case that her saying, you have a choice, you know, it's not the coin, it's you, despite your great reading of the coin and the location and him and the cosmos, I want that to somehow get through to him and for him to say, no, you're right.
I think the hope comes from the car accident, not from the possibility that he doesn't kill her. Mm. It comes from he's made all of these claims throughout the film that everybody lives by rules and they bring them to certain places as if everybody's chosen to be in front of him, right? And then he discovers that he doesn't choose where he's ended up either. You know, he thinks that with this rule, he can control everything and where everything ends up and how everything turns out. But that's not really true.
Right.
And the car accident shows that contingency affects him too.
Right. But her point could have also indicated contingency, right? Like the fact that he is there. What's contingent is that he does have a choice about whether he kills her or not.
But her point really isn't any different from all the other versions of this he's already heard, which is why he's laughing at her as he says, "Why you don't have to do this? Everybody always says that."
Sure, she says that. But what I'm trying to say, or what I said, is that she means it differently than the other people, right? She's not saying it to plead with her. She already knows that he's going to be there and that he's planning to kill her because she says, I knew you were here. I knew you'd turn up. She's not surprised that he's there. So when she says, you don't have to do this, she's not saying it in a pleading way. She's saying it in a fundamental way that is trying to remind whatever part of him that still persists, if it exists at all, that he has a conscience and that he can decide not to kill her or anybody else.
But I think he laughs at her in part because "you don't have to do this" always does have that double meaning. "You don't have to do this" is both a plea and it's a serious attempt to try to reach somebody. And it can be done in a way that's more emphasizing the pleading angle. Someone can say it in an emotional, desperate sounding way. She doesn't say it in an emotional, desperate sounding way. But of course, she doesn't want to die. It is still a plea. It's just a plea that's being done in a more solemn, serious way than it has been done previously. But that's not going to make an effect on him. The tone of it isn't going to change the way he receives it. Everything we know about him from this film indicates
maybe
that.
He's checking his boots just out of habit, not because there's blood on them. I really don't want her to die.
I don't think so.
I really don't want her to die. It's fine. I can't live with the idea that he killed her. It's okay. What about this question of evil as kind of incomprehensibility or some of the other things about America and the kind of founding of evil and justice as the two poles?
Well, I think in some ways the film kind of pushes against the idea that evil is incomprehensible, right? We start off with this guy who seems incomprehensible. And the one thing that we didn't really talk about is the Woody Harrelson character, the bounty hunter, who suggests he has kind of knowledge of this guy. And when Woody Harrelson shows up, it's mainly to explain to the guy who's on the run with the money that he's really in over his head here. This isn't somebody you can talk to or negotiate with. There's no bargaining with this guy. And eventually, the psychopath catches up to the Woody Harrelson character. And even though the Woody Harrelson character thinks he's clever enough and capable enough to hang with this guy, it turns out that that's not the case either. And he ends up having to do the same stupid thing everybody has to do when they get into a room with him and try desperately to talk him out of it, unsuccessfully, ultimately. And I think that this idea that he's inexplicable is itself the thing the film is pushing against. We say he's inexplicable to distance ourselves from him, when really we're all part of the same unfolding whole as him. So of course we know on some level what's explicable about him. We all feel that we have, sometimes that fate is pulling us in particular directions and that we don't really have any choice but to do or to
right, but I think the difference between what we're saying is where we locate this determinism, right? So I'm saying, yes, the point would be that we have to look at ourselves and understand that this darkness, which is extreme in him, is not distant from us, not as distant from us as we would like, right? That we need in order to understand him, we need to understand our own dark sides. But you're presenting it more in the context of a kind of determinism, a kind of cosmic determinism framework.
Yeah, I'm taking the cosmic determinism in the film a little bit more seriously, but still with this contingency in the film that the kind of, I think there's an argument in the film that this cosmic determinism thing is generally a very important factor, much more important than our individual autonomy or agency, that ultimately these are all three very similar men who by luck or by fate ended up in different roles in different places in the society, but they're all at bottom quite similar. And if things had been a little different, they all could have been each other, right? But contingency is the thing that gets you out of it, because contingency can take even the person who's been by fate put in the worst possible situation and molded into the worst possible character. It can still stop that person from disseminating evil throughout the universe.
Right. And I guess the flip side of this would be the call of conscience that the welder feels when he wakes up in the night, or he's awoken, or he's still awake by his thoughts of the fact that there's a dying man, and in his attempt to bring water to the presumably then dead man, he inaugurates a whole world of trouble for himself that he wouldn't have done. So it's very obvious that conscience in and of itself does not necessarily bring about a good result, right? So the whole point is, I mean, of course you could say, well, there are many, many different things he could have done, right? When seeing the scene, he randomly stumbles across this scene of carnage, right? He could have immediately left and called the police. He could, you know, there's all kinds of different things at different points he could have done. And he does something in between. And he's constantly in between the whole film, in a way. And by returning with the water, which he, you know, because of his moral qualm, basically, he brings it back. But then he's in real trouble, because then they find out who he is.
Well, yeah, we could say that he could have done all of these things, but in a way, it was his fate to be the kind of person both who would take the briefcase and who would return with water.
Right.
Right? He's neither someone who refuses the briefcase, nor someone who can do without bringing water to the guy in the end.
Yeah. No, I agree, which means he's in the middle. And in a way, he's the kind of most relatable character, because I think in that if we care about such things, but I mean, in the sense that, you know, he takes advantage of a situation, but at the same time, he's still beholden to, you know, let's say, normal altruistic impulses, even in the face of a terrible scene. You know, I mean, the scene of carnage with the bodies and so on.
And that word, I think that word's very important, beholden. He doesn't really have a choice about it because of where he's, the kind of person he is, and the moment that he's been brought to by his unfolding
but
life.
I know. I think this is the point of tension between us, though, because I think, sure, I mean, look, the film aside, I mean, I absolutely take this film to be a film about determinism, maybe even quite a Gnostic film, maybe quite a, you know, not a nihilistic film, but a very, very stark and harsh film, right? It reminds me of other things like the first season of True Detective or something like this, you know what I mean? Like things that are very masculine, very dry, very kind of brutal. So I certainly accept that this is what the film is presenting, this kind of universe, a universe that is largely determined with a small amount of contingency, very little hope. You know, certainly nobody can assume the mantle of justice giver. There's a series of colliding laws and different rules for living. There is no overarching majesty. Like there is no kind of transcendent unifying law or good or God or anything like this that unifies the laws, the different laws, right? There's no higher meaning other than these.
Well, there might be, but it's not straightforwardly graspable.
No.
And the way that things are determined tend to lead people away from it in various ways. Right? The aspects of this, the way it's set up, tend to lead people away from it. But not all the way away from it, because there's both justice and injustice in a Cormac McCarthy universe. And so even though there's a lot of violence and a lot of injustice, it's never total in one direction or the other. And the hope that I think Cormac McCarthy tends to bring into his novels is this presence of the other side, which also can't be extinguished, right? Most stories are focused on the good and yet there's evil and oh, we can't extinguish the evil, right? Cormac McCarthy goes, there's evil and yet there's good and we can't extinguish the good either.
Sure, I do understand.
There's a lot of hope, I think, in Cormac McCarthy stories, because ultimately the focus is on, but there's still good.
But this is a bit like...
Whereas a lot of other stories go the other way around.
No, I take your point. I mean, but it's sort of like hope is a glass of sour milk, you know? I mean, it's very little hope, I would say, which is fine. I mean, it's a bit like Pandora's box in a way, you know? It's sort of the remaining thing, but the thing that's left over almost as a temptation is hope, right? Like hope is still, is, you know.
But this is very difficult to extinguish.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of hope narratives, it's very easy to poke holes in them because there's so much an attempt to not deal with the awfulness and the badness of what goes on. But because Cormac McCarthy starts with awfulness and makes no attempt to hide from it at all, when he does arrive at hope at the end, it's much more difficult to extinguish that hope. And I was left in watching the sheriff scene at the end, feeling that the sheriff had really been a quitter, that the sheriff should have kept trying to do good. And it was because the sheriff insisted that he had to completely change the universe by his actions, or he wouldn't bother acting at all. This all or nothing relationship to justice that the sheriff has, where either he has to be this decisive factor who can bring about a perfect world, or he'll just quit because it's too much for him.
Yeah. I mean,
I think that that critique of the sheriff figure is really powerful and is an invitation to us to continue to strive to make things marginally better with an awareness that we are not going to change fundamentally the nature of the universe.
Yeah, in that regard, I think his wife is a very complimentary figure because she, in a way, is reminding him of the fact that they're alive, like the beauty of the moment, the fact that they do have a life together, that, you know, she is much more pragmatic, but it much more grateful, it seems to me, like he's aspiring to these grand narratives. And she's saying, in a way, well, yes, but, you know, look where we are, like we have this, we have each other, we have our life, you know, which is another kind of hope in the form of a much more minimal set of expectations, which unsurprisingly, when met, are much more beautiful, right? Like, so to be grateful for waking up every day, for example. And I think, you know, if you're in sort of programs or, you know, organizations for recovery from addiction, these are the sorts of things, and mainstream religion, to be honest. I mean, these are the things that are sort of stressed constantly, which is like gratitude for waking up, you know, gratitude for being alive, gratitude for seeing flowers, gratitude, do you know what I mean? Because one of the major problems with, I don't know, people relapsing or whatever, is that they feel like the universe, let's go put it in your language, is unfair, and that they're being treated unfairly, and as a consequence they must do the thing that's bad for them. Do you see what I mean? To kind of make amends, or not make amends, to right some injustice or right some balance, or do you know what I mean? Whereas if you never get to that point of resentment, then you don't need to do the thing that's really bad for you. Putting it badly, but
yeah, to pretend that Helen is here, right? The sheriff has this image of a universe that was whole and complete before some kind of social decay or corruption happened to it. And then he feels unequal to the task of stopping or reversing this decay or corruption. But what he doesn't realize is that the universe was always already incomplete. Mm-hmm. It's just that at that earlier stage, he was not as conscious of the incompleteness as his career spent working as a sheriff has forced him to become conscious of it. And this is something that I love to point out. The jobs that we do, the roles we perform, make us conscious of particular things about the universe, particular aspects that we regularly come into confrontation with through the specific professions that we take up. Mm-hmm. And one of the effects of this is that a person who's been in a profession for 30 or 40 years tends to develop a warped mm-hmm. perspective that's unduly influenced by the particular parts of the universe that their profession repeatedly confronts them with, right? So the fact that he's been a sheriff for 30 or 40 years in this kind of situation, it gives him this sort of a viewpoint. But that viewpoint is necessarily distorted. And I think that this is something that I've seen with lawyers. It's something I've seen with medical doctors, that there's an effect of doing the profession that tends to be epistemologically negative. It tends to produce, even though on one level, the person is very experienced, the sheriff, if you put him in the kinds of situations that he is experienced in, certainly he knows how to navigate those situations better than a rookie cop mm-hmm. would, right? But a rookie cop, because he's not been a cop for his whole life, has a more balanced view of the universe than the sheriff does.
Interesting. I mean, to go back to your point about the decreasing appearance of violence, it's interesting that the sheriff repeatedly says, I don't need to see the scene again. You know, so it's actually mirrored in what he says, like, I don't need to go back. I don't need to see more violence. I don't need to see the body, and so on and so forth, right? Right, because in a way, what's new about that, right? Like, we're so immune to violence and so on. It's interesting. I was thinking when you're talking about the epistemic perspectivalism, I suppose, of the repeated job, the role. I mean, A, first of all, how many people probably don't have jobs for life in that way. But B, thinking about my father, who was an NHS dentist for 40 years, you know, and he was, you know, very well loved as a dentist, and he's still very well loved, but, you know, by the community. He saw 40 people a day, many days. He was very, very busy. He knew everybody where we lived in the nearby town. And So, but it was very social. It was a very, very social job, precisely because he was seeing all these people. And if we go out now, people will always say hi to him because, of course, they remember him. People were very sad when he retired. People tried to keep coaxing him out because they want him to treat them for free or for not very much money, and they trust him. You know, he's a very trustworthy human being. And but one of the things that happened to my father was severe hearing loss as a consequence of using the drill for 40 years. And in a way, it's one of these occupational hazards, right? It's literally kind of part of the job. Like, that's what it is. And so now he has hearing aids. His hearing is very bad. He, you know, he still loves music. He plays music and listens to music, but it's very difficult. And but he is not at all upset, it seems to me, by this outcome, like this life of doing service and you know, working and treating people, but at the cost of his hearing, largely. And it's interesting that he doesn't have a kind of bitterness about the hearing. He definitely, I think, prefers not to be so sociable. Like, it's hard to see 40 people a day. Like, I don't think I could take it at all. Like, I would not be able to deal with that for a second. but it's, I don't know. How has it shaped his perspective? I would say from a moral point of view, he thinks that most people are fundamentally good. Yeah, he is actually very optimistic about human nature, which is interesting. He's,
you know, something that sticks out to me about that. He saw lots of people in the community, and he saw them in contexts where he was helping them with a problem that they had, and they were grateful for it. And so there's a positive interaction that tends to end well for all concerned. Mm-hmm. And it's with a very diverse selection of the population, because people from all classes and backgrounds have teeth problems. And I think that that's... So some people, they change their job, their profession, their role all the time. Other people manage to find a way to do one role or one job really well, because they find a way to socially embed it in such a way that they can sustain it across time, and in such a way that they deal with a broad enough intersection of people that their perspective isn't narrowed. And it sounds like maybe in your father's case, he was able to do that. Whereas a cop who only sees people in very bad situations.
Sure, I just saw someone get violently arrested earlier today, and it's frightening. I mean, For all concerned, you know what I mean? The amount of adrenaline that's like going on in those situations, they're very fast, they're very physically brutal. But sure.
Or a lawyer who only sees people in cases where they're involved in a very nasty dispute.
No, for sure. You're right. It's interesting that the one thing my father did do that was perhaps a little unorthodox, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, was to... Towards the end of his career, he wrote off loads of money. Like, he didn't make people pay when they couldn't afford it. I mean, at all. And all of the treatment he was doing was on the NHS anyway. But you normally have to pay like a little fee towards it, and then it's matched. It's a complicated, weird system, and they changed it towards the end. But I think either because my father could not deal with the new bureaucracy, and because he knew he had like the last good NHS pension waiting for him, or, you know, he's extremely frugal, ascetically. He doesn't spend money on anything anyway. Like, money is not interesting for my father, or he's not concerned with it. But it was very interesting that he, much to my mother's slight annoyance, had given away enormous amounts of treatment for free, which I think is a very moral thing to do. I think it reflects very well on my father, because there are lots of poor people where we live. And he was also treating people who were in the army, who the army weren't able to, you know, give good enough treatment or whatever. So he did see a lot of people like that. And yeah, so I find that kind of interesting. But yeah, I don't know. But I think that's moral luck, right? That's circumstance. My father makes a rational calculation and says, well, I don't need this money, right? I'm okay like, my life is good. And my father says this all the time. I have a good life. You know, everything is great. I love my wife. I have a house to live in. You know, like, he's extremely grateful on a...
Yes, and this is because of the time when he was born, the place where he was born. You know, he has the fate to be someone who can refuse that money.
Yeah.
You know, who doesn't need it. And who's had a life experience that allows him to feel good about not taking it. Some people, even though they have money and they don't need more, something about from their childhood or their past makes it very difficult for them to let go of money or to not grasp it when it's before them.
Yeah, but then, well, what makes the difference? You know, I mean, this is where, well, again, we're just back in this place, like where we're locating necessity and where we're locating contingency, right? I want to locate it in something like conscience. I want to say that people have the capacity to choose, right?
Yeah, see, I tend to say that there's what we can theorize, and then there's what no theory can really account for, because human theories can only be so complicated, because the human mind can only hold so much in it at once and so many variables in it at once. And we put in the box of contingency the things that our theories can't account for. And whether we could have a theory that would in principle account for all of that, whether some hyper-intelligent being could have a theory that would account for all of that, I don't know.
No, but bring it down to...
Human theories can't account for everything.
No, but bring it down to earth. I mean, there are many situations we all find ourselves in where we have a decision to make that has, let's say, in a simple version, two possible parts, right?
Yes, people always want to give themselves credit for the way that they go.
Yes.
And I never want to give people credit or blame for the way that they go when it seems like they have two choices. It's just that fate has brought them to the edge of a knife, and they can't see as they approach the edge which way they're going to go. But I do think that if we had a sufficiently total perspective, which we can't have as embodied beings, that we would know which way they were going to go.
Right, but that makes no sense as a kind of sort of theoretical speculation. I mean, sure, like hypothetically, sure, like given enough levels, given enough information, but this is not, let's put it this way, I mean, in a very blunt way, this is not the experience one has when making a decision.
Yes, we have the appearance of being individuals, but I think that appearance conflicts with what's really true.
No, but we don't have to think of ourselves as individuals. I mean, a moral agent, well, you know, whether we call the moral agent an individual or not, but I think, you know, we are presented... Well, okay, let's put it this way. What's the point? What's the purpose of having conscience? What's the purpose of having this epiphenomenon of choice, the appearance of choice?
Well, I would say it's that it's a consequence of the way consciousness comes about in this kind of physical universe, right? In this physical universe, consciousness comes about in a point, and that point is not completely connected synthesized with all the other points. So it has this appearance of separation from those points, but they all grow out of the same thing.
I mean,
I think it's...
Go on.
You know, this is kind of the sense in which, you know, when Plato says that we have different kinds of souls, that like a medical doctor has a particular kind of soul, I don't think he really means that there's, you know, in the realm of the forms, a doctor soul that then comes down and is put in a person. What he means is that there is a kind of perspective that grows out of the whole, the world soul in Neoplatonism, this perspective, which is the doctor's perspective, that if you happen to be in the place within the world where you can't have anything other than that perspective, then, you know, that's the way in which soul manifests in you. That's the way in which consciousness manifests in you.
Sure. But I mean, is it, another way, I mean, why is this not just an eliminative materialist position in which all of these appearances are epiphenomena?
Well, because I do think that there is, you know, something that's beyond what we are able to apprehend. I think eliminativist materialists, they ultimately will come back to, well, this is what it seems like we are, so why don't we just say this is what is? Because the materialists tend to be empiricists, right? And a kind of strict empiricism leads to this idea that, well, it seems like we're separate, individuated animals that have just different levels of intelligence. And therefore, that's what we must be, because that's what it seems like we are. I think a weakness of empiricism in general is that empiricism takes appearance too seriously, because experience is always, it appears in this individuated way. Our senses don't equip us in and of themselves to grasp beyond the individual.
How do we have any access to a kind of world being or cosmic being then?
Well, I think it comes out of this notion of the good, that there is nonetheless, despite the fact that we are all individuated and we have this appearance to ourselves and to each other of being individuals, we also have this sense that we can stand outside our own individual perspective and think about abstractly something larger than ourselves. We all have the capacity to do this. And the fact that we have the capacity to do it, I think, gestures at something beyond the individual, that there's some capacity of comprehending a whole that we see from a point of view that is itself an expression of that unfolding whole.
But is this perception or this perspective merely human, right? But at the collective level, right? Because people like Feuerbach, for example, will say, like, man's capacity to think the infinite is, you know, man's infinite capacity to think, right? Which is to say, and all these kind of riddles, right? But in the sense of saying, like, when man thinks, man does not think individually, man is thinking collectively, man is thinking like qua man, right? But is this capacity to abstract and even to think of, even to have a discussion, let's say, about the idea of the collective idea of good, or, you know, these sorts of possibilities, does that tell us something merely about our collective being at the level of what kind of creature we are? Or does it tell us something about the universe?
Well, I think it's difficult to say, because we don't really have access to what it's like to be a rock or a tiger or a tree.
Or a bat.
Yeah, we don't really have access to that. We can anthropomorphize, so we have the capacity to project qualities that we only really know that we have onto other things out there. So we have the ability to imagine, what if it is the case that there is something like a tree soul or a rock soul or something like that?
There is.
Well, if you think that there is, then it certainly does tell us about something other than just humans.
No, sure. It's just interesting to think about the origins of the word empathy, because in German, the empathy was not fellow feeling. It was feeling with the landscape. It was actually understanding nature. You know, it has nothing to do with this kind of, you know, intra-human idea that we generally use today, right?
Yeah, this intersubjective, as if we're a bunch of different, separate, and distinct entities that engage in some kind of international diplomacy.
Yes, which apparently breaks down quite often.
Yeah, sovereign citizen individuals that are struggling to engage in diplomacy with each other.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I mean, when one likes somebody or is friends with somebody or loves somebody, we sort of love their individuated being, don't we?
I think we love the whole universe as expressed in them. We love the universe that we're able to, or that we think we're able to see through them, right?
Yeah.
So, but of course, if we were to become confused and to think it was just them that we loved, we would forget that in loving them, we were loving the whole thing. We were loving the possibility of the whole thing that we saw in that point. So when someone dies, I think it's important to remember that it was the whole universe, the quality of the whole universe that we had been appreciating, not just them. And that quality is still in the universe. It's just not concentrated into that point.
Yeah, I don't disagree, although it is very difficult to disentangle the universe from a person. I mean, or to understand that they're fragment of the universe. You know, I mean, one does feel sad. Let's be fair. I think sad for them, sad for you, sad for other people. I mean, I take the point. But it, you know, it's, I think Plato makes a similar point, doesn't he? You know, the one should not confuse the beauty of the boy with the boy, right? In a sense, yeah. Right? So one should not confuse. But then, okay, take something like friendship, right? Friendship is a very interesting question. We were talking with Avital Ronell. Deconstruction is very obsessed with friendship. I think friendship is like the most central question of deconstruction, actually, in the end. This is my conclusion. But something like friendship is difficult to abstract. I mean, obviously, Aristotle has a go, for example, three different kinds of friendship. We can categorize different types of friendship, sure. But friendship doesn't really, it's hard to understand what friendship is outside of an experience of friendship, right? And I suppose there's something about the qualitative nature of relationships that makes it extremely difficult to disentangle the macro from the micro, and that one is sorely tempted to say that one loves this person, qua this person, not qua access to the universe. I mean, Badiou actually makes this point about love. I mean, Badiou says that love is actually access to the universe. This is one of his definitions. You know, he says it's not gazing into the eyes of the other. It's gazing at the universe with someone else, right? Something like this.
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes it sad when someone dies is that there are very few points that will really strike any one of us as points where we can gain insight into or grasp the wonderfulness of the whole thing. And so when someone dies, I think we all have a fear that we will never see the universe in the same way again, that we'll never find another point. Mm-hmm. You know, it's as if you found a beautiful door into something and then the door was taken from you. And you know, in principle, there are other doors, but will you ever find one? And even if you find another door, will it be as brilliant or as bright as the one that you found? There's a tendency to think there couldn't possibly be another point as brilliant or bright as the one that you found. And I think we have a tendency to think that in large part because the universe is so lacking and frustrating, and it is quite difficult to find people that make us see what's good about it. Mm-hmm. So when we lose one of those people, it is very difficult for us to retain the memory of what we saw, unless we have some kind of spiritual praxis that allows us to remember this.
Yes. I mean, I have to remind myself when I think of people who've died that I loved as friends, but, you know, in their uniqueness, or so I thought, that they are not sort of lost completely, right? I have to, when I remember them, I actually also feel that they are at peace somehow. And it's important that I think that, you know, but I'm somehow convinced that they are, you know, through reflection, upon reflection.
That's interesting. Mm. I remember my dad when I start to feel very, very bad about the universe. I remember my dad and go, well, it can't be so bad.
Hmm.
Because that person could exist in it for mm-hmm. a period of time. There must be other people like that.
Yes.
Even if I can't find them right this minute.
No, I mean, I think there definitely are. And I think what is interesting about life is its surprising quality, that one encounters people, or even one returns to the same person who you thought you knew, who has become, or your relation to them has changed in very interesting ways. So there is something kind of surprising. I don't know if surprise is the same as contingency. Maybe surprise is just another way of looking at the same thing. That's what surprise is.
Yeah, and I'm kind of taking this in a bit of a Cormac McCarthy direction. You know, I think we do have this experience that we tend to get lost in how bad the whole thing is and to forget that there are these moments or these places within the universe where you can glimpse this other side that it has. And it's insofar as we have a reason to go on, it's not because all of that is everywhere all the time, very obvious to us. Although some spiritual practitioners claim that if you do the right kind of spiritual praxis, you will have that experience. I don't know that that's true. I've never been fully convinced of that.
You should try yoga, Benjamin.
The whole thing, every part of it, just as good as the best part?
Absolutely.
I don't know. But at the very least, there are points and moments and places, and there will always be points and moments and places, no matter how bad the whole thing seems to become. And therefore, we never have to be so terribly afraid of anything happening that could, you know, to make the whole thing bad. Mm-hmm. Nothing can make the whole thing bad any more than anything can make the whole thing good. That's what I like about Cormac McCarthy.
Amen.
All right. We're going to go do the B-side now for our Patreon listeners. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.